This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Literature and music are, of course, entertaining, but they're also a source of cultural power. A new audio drama that airs this weekend on WUNC explores that idea. The Witches of Lublin is an original play that has the feel of a folktale, and it takes a creative look at the role of gender, art, and faith in the messy business of defining a people. The play is set in 18th century Poland. It features a woman named Rivka who lives in Lublin. She's poor and without a husband, but she is the daughter of a great Jewish mystic, and she has become a Talmud scholar in her own right, a distinction customarily reserved for men. She teaches her two daughters and granddaughter klezmer music, again, the province of men. They're very good, but their skill brings unwanted attention and leaves Rivka with an impossible choice. You can hear the whole radio drama this Sunday at 6 p.m. on WUNC, but here to give us a preview are Sue Zizza. She is the director and co-producer of The Witches of Lublin, and Ellen Kushner and Yale Strom, who co-wrote the play. Yale also composed the music. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good to have you here. Sue, I should start with you and tell everybody that you and I have worked on a number of fascinating radio drama projects throughout the years. Great to have you on the program.
Well, thanks, Frank, and I'm glad you thought they were interesting projects over the years.
They were fascinating, and many of them even good. But that's a story for another show. Listen, this one I know is great as well as all of those others were. Tell us how this one came about.
Well, last spring I was called by a very dear friend of mine, who you also know from WGBH, Jane Pippick, mm-hmm. who asked me if I might know someone in New York who would be available to help Yale and Ellen and Elizabeth Strom, the third writer in the project, to find a home for the play. And I said, well, you know, Jane, I'm no longer the executive director of the National Audio Theater Festivals, where you and I used to work, Frank. Mm-hmm. And so as a result of that, my company, Sue Media Productions, is now the home of new audio dramas. And we had just finished a Jack Kerouac piece, which, in fact, UNC was kind enough to run. And I was looking for a new play. So as I went off to the Cannes Film Festival, Yale and Elizabeth and Ellen had hosted a workshop in New York where they invited a variety of directors, and I read the play. And then after they interviewed the other directors, I had an opportunity through the magic of Skype to call them from the south of France. And I explained to them why I really love these characters and what I thought together in a collaborative way the four of us could accomplish. And I'm delighted to say that of the choices they had, I was the one they selected.
Well, Ellen, let me ask you this question. I know, Yale, you and Ellen both co-wrote this along with a third writer. Tell us how this play came about. Give us an idea about the story itself. Ellen?
The story of how we all decided to write the play?
No, the
or
story.
The story of the story of the story.
The play itself.
The play itself. Actually, I think I'd have to hand this one to Yale mm-hmm. and to his wife and partner, the singer and filmmaker Elizabeth Schwartz, who couldn't be with us today. But they really had the genesis of the idea for the plot line. It was basically the three of us standing around the lobby of my apartment building in New York going, let's do something together. Let's do a cool project that has music and feminism and magic and a lot of Jewish stuff for public radio, because each of us intersects with those things in a kind of big and glorious Venn diagram. And the next thing I knew, I got a first draft from this magical couple, Yale Strom and Elizabeth Schwartz, pretty much laying out the idea. So, Yale, what did you guys do? Were you, like, having breakfast or did
actually,
you lock yourselves in a room or what?
Before I get to the sort of the culinary history of this, maybe what we could really get at is the plot itself, Yale.
Well, I'll tell the plot.
You know, and as I said, you know, we've been friends with Ellen, that being myself and my wife, Elizabeth Schwartz, and knowing Ellen's wonderful work in radio already. So I said, I'm the one who actually said, well, let's do something in radio. So that got us there. But what? And then we thought of a story, and Elizabeth actually said, you know, I remember reading something, and this was in a book of mine called The Book of Klezmer, you know, a scholarly book on the history of klezmer since medieval times through today. And I had found in research in the archives in Eastern Europe a very small passage, short passage, about women klezmer musicians in the 17th and 18th centuries, primarily Eastern Germany and some in Poland. And these would be women that would go to very large markets. In other words, there were market times where 3-4 times a year you came because you traveled quite a distance. There was going to be more selection. You brought a larger selection to sell as well. You were looking for things to buy. And it was a way to meet people, news gathering, giving news. And, you know, and I put this in my book. But then, you know, it stuck in my mind, and particularly Elizabeth, that, wow, you know, here we think that women only really since the early part of the 20th century were allowed to be in that world. And, of course, those listening would say, well, why is that? Well, modesty issues, as we say in Yiddish, niyistik. Modesty is something, you know, comes from the Middle East. Both Orthodox Judaism and Orthodox Islam, women have modesty issues, dress, when they can sing or not sing in front of men, et cetera, et cetera. So the same for Jewish women. And so we thought we'd take this idea and really expand upon it and see where we could take this, knowing that there were some instances where women did play klezmer music for non-Jews, but for Jews as well, because at these markets that I will say that I did the research, there were many Jews coming to them, and men as well.
And Ellen, in this play, there's another area of transgression, and that is that Rivka is something of a Talmud scholar, which had been the province of men.
That's right. The real focus for us in the show was this tension between women who have this artistic and scholarly heritage. In this case, she's learned from her father and her grandfather, and she has a passion for it and a love for it, and she's enacting that passion by playing music and playing music with her daughters because, you know, when you've got that kind of passion, it's very hard to keep it down when you're a human being. Setting her in 18th century Poland in a fairly traditional Jewish community, let us explore that tension and what it would mean if you had all that and you were in a community that kind of at best was frightened by it and at worst rejected it.
Yeah, so there's a scene in the play where a guest is having dinner with Rivka, her sister, and her sister's husband, the rabbi. And in it, we see how Rivka's confidence and knowledge sometimes get her in trouble. Let's listen.
And now, Rabbi, I must ask you about Passover in Lublin. I'm afraid I won't make it home to Minsk in time for the Seders.
We always make more than enough, and we'd be honored to have you.
Oh, thank you. And where do you buy your matzahs, Rebitzin?
Oh, we always buy Passover matzahs from the local baker, a good man.
Really, Rabbi? I thought you'd buy them from the great scholar, Reb Gedalia.
Isn't Reb Gedalia the one who turns away the poor from his shop if they can't pay right away?
Rivka, why don't we go get the tea ready?
He has no kindness the rest of the year. Why should Pesach be any different?
Thank you, sister. That's enough.
Yes, brother.
By the way, Rabbi, I met this Reb Gedalia at the synagogue today, and I can tell you he impresses me as a true scholar. A real Talmud Chochem.
Religious scholarship alone does not guarantee ethical behavior.
Oh, really? Says who?
Maimonides. In the chapter Hilchos Deos, Maimonides states that a Talmud Chochem is known by his behavior to others.
Rivka,
as much as
I need you and the girls in the kitchen.
And he writes that.
Now!
What a strange woman.
She forgets her place.
To forget one's place, one must know it to begin with.
A scene from The Witches of Lublin, which will air this Sunday at 6 p.m. on WUNC. Right now, co-writers Ellen Kushner and Yael Strom are with me, as well as co-producer and director Sue Zizza. Ellen, in that scene, we get the sense of the tension within the Jewish community over these roles. But then, as you said, there's a tension outside because the greater community, in which Jews are a minority, they play out. They come to the attention of the Duke. The Duke wants them to play even more. And now they're going to have to go public within their community. And then we see the tensions within their community and now over and against the dominant society as well. The Count, I'm sorry. I said the Duke.
Was that a question or were you about to play that clip?
No. So give us a sense then. You're wrestling with both of these. This is something that had you intended to get into the play from the beginning, these both of these tensions within the community and also against the dominant society as well.
What you need to understand is that Jews were not merely a minority. They were considered an alien race that was inhabiting the land of the Poles. They weren't Polish citizens. They didn't have any rights. And they were there in large part because the local authorities, in this case the Count, Graf Sobieski, played by the fabulous Simon Jones, I have to add, because the Count thinks it's useful to have them there. And they've been there for generations, and they think of this as their home. But they're very well aware that at any moment, the local authorities could decide that they're a menace to society and have them chased out at best and at worst, you know, massacred and raped and pillaged. There was actually a name for this kind of treatment called a pogrom. And everybody is very worried at the time of Passover that this pogrom might be coming up, as they often did in the spring. So there's that tension in the play as well. And, you know, very much like I'm going to go out on a limb and say like African-Americans in the American South, there's a sense that every Jew represented all Jews in every single interaction that they had with the Polish authorities. And therefore, when Rivka and her girls are, quote, invited, actually commanded to play for a Polish party, even though in the eyes of their own community this is a dreadful thing to do, they and their community know that not only do they have to do it, but if they do it badly, there's a chance that the whole community could get washed out.
And Yael Strom, music plays an important part of this. You've written music for this. Why not use klezmer music that already existed?
Well, we did. I used music that's folk and music that I wrote. I wanted to, as a composer, you always want to challenge yourself, and it's fun to be able to come up with something that sounds like it could have come from that very era. So, for example, the scene that you actually just played, when it continues, they sing what we call a couple table songs, table wordless songs, and those are tunes that I wrote. And as a matter of fact, a friend of mine in the play, Sam Gunsler, he said, "Yeah, you know, these sound as if I've known these for, you know, all my life," which is a good compliment because he's also a cantor as well as an actor, meaning I guess I did a pretty good job. But there's a tune called Der Bruschen Scher. A scher is a type of, what we'd call a square dance. And, another piece called, Steingart Skotschna, which is a hopping type of dance. And those are tunes that I actually got from a collection from, a great Soviet, Jewish, ethnomusicologist who did research in the 30s in Ukraine. And this part of Ukraine was also part of Poland, Greater Poland at one time. And you know, these melodies have been around for many decades, if not hundreds of years. So I thought to use both folk material from the actual region and to write. I just want to add one thing, though. You know, Rivka is a learned woman, as well as her daughters, of course. There was precedence that there were learned Jewish women, you know, studying Talmud, Torah. This wasn't something completely unusual. For example, I'll mention two famous people. One, the daughter of Rashi, and this is in the, I'm going to say, the 12th century. He's the most famous in the world today for all Jews, whether you're Sephardic, Mizrahi, Eastern, secular, Hasidic, or Ashkenazic. The most famous commentator of the Torah, and he had no sons, and he taught his daughter everything he knew, so she was quite brilliant, and holding court, so to speak, classes with other people.
Can I interrupt for a second?
And I just wanted to say just one last thing, though. Also, there was a Hasidic Rebbe in the 19th century known as the Maiden of Ludmir, who dressed up as a man.
But fairly unusual, you'd have to admit. Not common.
Unusual.
Let me ask Sue Zizza a question.
To think that women did not, even among themselves, have their own sort of learning circle, so to speak. There were. But you're right. It was not common, particularly the music. The learning was much more, I can find more historical incidences where this happened more than I have found, you know, where women were outside and traveling and playing music.
Sue Zizza, tell us about the challenges of creating a story like this for the ear.
Well, first of all, Frank, the thing that I do want to say about this is that even though it's happening in Poland and it's Jews, if you listen to the story, I think it could be Darfur, It could be the American South. It could be any place where, unfortunately, the human condition is to oppress someone else in order to feel powerful. And that was really what spoke to me about the play. So when I was in the process of working with the three writers to cast the piece, the first thing we had to do is we had to find that chorus of voices that would uniquely represent each one of the characters, so that whether it was Rivka, played by the wonderful and fabulous Tova Felshu, or Mrs. Chaya, played by Barbara Rosenblatt, or any of the other women in the play, Leah, Sorla, we had to make sure that the voices would stand up and represent each one of the characters instantly, so that the ear could create a picture for the listener. And then in the men, it was the same thing. Simon, we had the wonderful Neil Gaiman come in and do a guest performance for us as the young Bogdan. And working with him and Simon was quite an interesting challenge, because Neil was in Minneapolis, Simon was in New York, and we had a young actor named Lucian Dodge double for him while we recorded the big cast all together to create the kind of energy and the kind of chemistry you want for a community, to make these people sound like they really did live together forever. And in working with Simon and Neil in particular, they had to take their very British accents and find a way to make them have that royal but not British sound, so that they would feel like, again, part of the larger Polish community. And then there was the sound design. And one of the wonderful joys of the experience was having an opportunity to learn from Yale and work with Yale and my recording partner, David Shin, how to capture in an acoustic environment the tunes and the songs. And in fact, in the process of putting together the project, when I sat down with Yale and we were looking at how much of each one of these songs were really going to be featured in the clear, given the drama and the pacing of putting this kind of story together, we ended up recording the songs completely to create a companion album,
which
Miriam Margulies.
I've got to go. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Suze is a director and co-producer of Witches of Lublin, Ellen Kushner, playwright of Witches of Lublin, Yale Strom, playwright and composer. You can hear it this Sunday at 6 o'clock on The State of Things. Well, no, you can hear it on WUNC. We're The State of Things. We actually take the weekend off. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.